Has Canada's stance toward U.S.-Iraq war resistors seeking refuge in Canada changed in any fundamental way as a result of the change in government? Is there reason to be concerned if the four war resistors going to court April 5th and 6th are ordered to leave the country? What is the background of Lockheed Martin Corporation, the company to whom Statistics Canada outsourced the 2006 and 2011 census? And why should Canadians be concerned? Is the notion of a mandatory census a breach of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms? Is Lockheed Martin, together with state governments, working to build the infrastructure of a global police state? On this week's Global Research NewsHour, we check in on the state of freedoms in Canada. Our first guest, Michelle Robidoux, campaigner with the War Resisters Support Campaign, tells us about four military deserters from the United States still facing the threat of deportation in spite of last October's change in government. In the second half hour, community activist Sandra Finley shares her understanding of the census contract with Lockheed Martin and the implications for Canadians' privacy and Canadian sovereignty. On this week's program, Canada and the American Empire, losing the ability to protect conscientious objectors and private information. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of April 1st, 2016. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Treaty 1 territory in the heart of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. The U.S. falsely blamed Iraq for playing a role in the 9/11 attacks, as shown by a memo from the Defense Secretary, as one of the main justifications for launching the Iraq War. Even after the 9/11 Commission admitted that there was no connection, Dick Cheney said that the evidence is quote-unquote overwhelming, that al-Qaeda had a relationship with Saddam Hussein's regime, that Cheney probably had information unavailable to the commission, and that the media was not doing their homework in reporting such ties. Top U.S. government officials now admit that the Iraq War was really launched for oil, not 9/11 or weapons of mass destruction. Many U.S. officials have alleged that 9/11 was a false flag operation by rogue elements of the U.S. government, but such a claim is beyond the scope of this discussion. The key point is that the U.S. falsely blamed it on Iraq, when it knew Iraq had nothing to do with it. That comes from the article, Governments Admit That Much of Modern History Has Been Manipulated by False Flag Attacks, by Washington's blog, posted March 31st. Sitting in the Oval Office, Trump will listen carefully to the advice of Walid Fares, who no doubt will advocate for regime change and aggressive policies in the Middle East, as he has throughout the last three decades. Trump will be told of the need to dispense massively lucrative contracts to the private military firms with whom his close advisors Keith Kellogg and Joe Schmitz have long relationships. He'll be cajoled to follow through with aggressive actions that will benefit Big Oil and Wall Street, all the buddies and pals of people like Carter Page. Trump will make deals based on the advice of Israeli mouthpieces like George Papadopoulos, not based on reason, let alone strategy in the interests of the U.S. In practical terms, Trump will likely escalate America's mostly fictional and superficial war on ISIS, embroiling the U.S. in yet another regional war as he puts boots on the ground in Syria and or Iraq. That comes from the article, President Trump, Who's Who in Trump's Foreign Policy Inner Circle, U.S. War Machine Rolls On, by Eric Dreitzer, posted March 30th, originally appearing at New Eastern Outlook. After Thursday's execution of a wounded young Palestinian man and his friend, who bled to death, was captured on tape, many details started emerging, including the involvement of an Israeli military medic in the crime. In one of the videos that captured this extrajudicial assassination of the already seriously wounded, completely incapacitated Palestinian, the sound of an Israeli colonialist settler, who is also a medic and a cameraman, could be heard saying, quote, "He is not dead. Shoot him in the head," unquote. The second video shows an Israeli soldier executing the wounded Palestinian Abdul Fattah Sharif with a gunshot to the head after conspiring with an Israeli colonialist settler to drive his van forward to block surveillance cameras and prevent onlookers from documenting the crime. The Israeli medics did not attempt any first aid on the two Palestinians, leaving one of them to bleed to death and executing the other. That comes from the article, "He's not dead, shoot him in the head," quote from Israeli medic. Posted March 30th, originally appearing at IMEMC. The Yediot Akronaut Conference, attacking BDS, has become a veritable carnival of hate. But the apogee came yesterday when Transportation Minister Israel Katz called for the, quote, "civil targeted killing," unquote, of BDS leaders like Omar Barghouti. Katz is saying that we won't physically murder BDS opponents, but we will do everything short of that. We are entering dangerous territory when an Israeli cabinet minister engages in wordplay that verges on putting a bullseye on the backs of nonviolent activists. In this torrid political environment in which Israeli leftists have become criminals and wounded Palestinian youth may be summarily executed in the street, it is only too easy to foresee Palestinian activists like Barghouti having a bounty on their heads. That comes from the article, "Israel Minister Calls for Civil Targeted Killings of BDS Leaders," by Richard Silverstein, posted March 30th, originally appearing at Tikkun Olam. The sole reason that the Islamic State could successfully attack Palmyra was a very large ongoing attack by al-Qaeda jihadists and CIA mercenary forces on the Syrian government forces in Idlib governorate. The Syrian army moved troops from Palmyra to defend Idlib and Latakia, and the forces left behind were no longer large enough to repel the Islamic State attack. The attack on Idlib, for which the CIA allowed its proxy forces to directly cooperate with al-Qaeda, was supported by electronic warfare from Turkey, which disrupted the Syrian military communication. The attack and the obvious cooperation between the jihadists and the Turkish and U.S. secret services was the reason that Russia and Iran decided to intervene in the conflict with their own forces. It had crossed their red line. That comes from the article, "Syria, How the Palmyra Victory Changes the Narrative," posted March 31st, originally appearing in Moon of Alabama. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Since January of 2004, American military service personnel started making their way to Canada seeking refuge from a U.S. war agenda in Iraq and Afghanistan that put them at odds with their conscience. The previous Harper government had taken a very strong and even hostile line against Iraq war resistors and deserters. A number of these conscientious objectors have been sent back to the United States, where they have faced lengthy prison sentences for desertion. As this episode goes to air, a number of war resistors' cases are reappearing in front of the federal court as part of litigation initiated by the former conservative government. The liberal government of Justin Trudeau struck a different tone with voters, pledging to deal with war resistors with a sense of compassion and openness to letting them stay in Canada. Yet they have not blocked the litigation moving forward on these war resistor cases. What follows is a clip from an encounter in July of 2015 between Alexina Key, the wife of war resister Joshua Key, and then Liberal leader and prime ministerial hopeful Justin Trudeau.
While the Harper government deports people like Kim Rivera, mother of four, to give birth in prison, and they cheered on the floor of the House of Commons.
I was there that day.
When she was arrested?
It was problematic. It was disappointing, and it wasn't worthy of the country that we are. And that's one of the things that I'm committed, among so many other things, to restoring our sense of compassion and openness and a place that is a safe haven for people to come here and build their lives and their futures as invaluable and important parts of our community.
Joining me now to talk about the current litigation facing three U.S. war resistors is Michelle Robidoux. She is a campaigner with the War Resisters Support Campaign based in Toronto, Canada. Good morning, Michelle.
Good morning, Michael.
Okay, so I think a lot of our listeners are somewhat familiar with the cause of allowing war resistors to stay in Canada. But they may be a little bit foggy about the actual process. Now, this is we're talking about people who have been in Canada now for almost a decade. And how many are we talking about?
I believe at this point there are 15 U.S. war resistors in Canada.
Yeah. And how many are facing litigation, the federal court, next week, April 5th
and
6th?
So, yes, April 5th and 6th at the federal court. There are four war resistors whose cases have been sort of amalgamated because the issues are so similar in the cases. And so this litigation was begun under the Harper government and is basically relitigating matters that the court had already found on in favor of the war resistors. So there have been a number of court cases where war resistors have had positive decisions. And this litigation next week will be re-looking at it. The government is pursuing litigation in the hopes of overturning positive decisions, essentially. So that litigation began under the Harper government. And, of course, there was an election in October, and we have a new government. And we've been very actively pursuing the question with our MPs all across the country, asking them to drop this litigation. Unfortunately, so far we haven't been successful, so it is going to court next Tuesday and Wednesday.
If we could just maybe back up a little bit in terms of like the actual process. I mean, if you know, resistors wanting to come to Canada and stay here, they have the option of trying to apply as a refugee or trying to apply for humanitarian and compassionate grounds, if I'm not mistaken. Have that course has been taken, right?
Yes. So,
and there's been negative actions in all of these cases?
Yeah. I mean, each case is slightly different, and each individual has a different experience that led them to leave the U.S. military and to seek asylum in Canada. But unlike the Vietnam War era, when, you know, there were many, many draft resistors and deserters who came to Canada and were allowed to stay, they simply could apply for landed immigrant status at the border. And if they had the required points, I think it was a point system at that time, they could be landed right there at the border. That's not the case today. And so individuals like Jeremy Hintzman and Joshua Key and others who people may know, who rejected the Iraq War and said they couldn't in good conscience participate in it, had only the option of applying for asylum. Now, there are really strong arguments for why they should be considered as political refugees, in the sense that the punishment that they face for refusing to participate in the war is not simple prosecution, but it's persecution based on their opinion. And the reason for that argument is, one of the reasons, is that there's evidence, abundant evidence, that if you are in Canada, you're a U.S. soldier, and you spoke out against the Iraq War and what you saw there, you are more harshly punished if you're returned to the U.S. than someone else who may have gone AWOL from the U.S. military. The vast majority of people who are AWOL or who have deserted, if they either turn themselves in or are caught, are administratively discharged. But U.S. war resistors who spoke out against the war in Canada have been harshly punished with sentences up to 24 months dishonorable discharge, bad conduct discharge, the equivalent of a felony conviction, which follows you for the rest of your life. So those are sort of the arguments about why U.S. war resisters should be allowed to stay under that mechanism. But there are, as you say, there's also the possibility of being accepted as a permanent resident on a humanitarian basis. And most of the war resistors have been here for more than 10 years. They've been in Canada. They've been they have roots in Canada. They have families in Canada. They have a life here. That's their life. Most of their adult life has been in Canada. And so all of the war resistors have a humanitarian and compassionate application. Some of them have also spousal sponsorships where they've married a Canadian born person and should be allowed to stay on that basis.
So the remaining resistors are waiting for answers from the humanitarian compassionate consideration and the spousal sponsorship application.
Exactly. And so now that we have a new government, our hope was that all of these applications could be relooked at, because under the Harper government, there was a systematic attempt to interfere in this process, both at the IRB, the Immigration and Refugee Board, and also in terms of direction to immigration officers, who are the ones who decide on humanitarian and compassionate applications, spousal sponsorships, and so on. They were instructed by then Minister Jason Kenney, who was the immigration minister. They were instructed to red flag applications by U.S. war resistors specifically and treat them as potentially criminally inadmissible.
So that's essentially like the Immigration Refugees Board has their process, and this directive from the former Citizenship and Immigration Minister essentially kind of trumps their regular decision-making?
Well, in the case of HNT applications and spousal sponsorships, it's clear that if you get a directive from your employer that's published on internet, you can look it up, Operational Bulletin 202. If you get that directive that says these individuals specifically need to be red flagged and sent basically to their headquarters to be treated differently as and potentially criminally inadmissible, I think that sends a very strong message to any immigration officer that your employer wants you to apply this lens to these cases. In terms of the IRB, now, members of the Refugee Board are, of course, independent decision makers. But again, when the minister at the time spoke out in the media, when war resisters cases were still being decided on at the IRB, and says these individuals are bogus refugee claimants, they are criminals, they are clogging up the system, and that kind of thing. Again, it's an unfair interference in what should be an impartial process. So none of the cases, from our point of view, can possibly have been dealt with on an even playing field in a fair way. And so we want the new government to relook at these applications, rescind that operational bulletin. There's no reason for U.S. war resistors, as opposed to Turkish or Russian or any other group of war resistors, to be singled out, and for immigration officers to be told these cases need to be looked at with a different lens. It's an interference in a process that should be based on the same rules for everybody. And in fact, the former chair of the IRB, Peter Scholler, published a letter at the time that this directive came in and said that this is an unprecedented kind of interference in that process.
My understanding, at least in the case of Joshua Key, that there was an understanding, a recognition on the part of the refugee board decision-making to recognize that, yes, there were concerns about the Iraq war and abuses that were taking place. But for some reason, I think my understanding is that in the United States, there's the feeling within Canada that they could get a fair hearing in the United States. But based on what you just said, that doesn't sound very likely. I mean, we have the precedence with the people who've already been sent back, as you just mentioned. Is there any area, you know, legally or politically, where you could bring this forward and say, how can you say that they're going to get a fair hearing in the States?
Well, this is exactly what the crux of the issue is for the litigation next week, because this issue has been looked at by the federal court. And in fact, a recent decision in the case of one war resister in 2013, Jules Tendungan, the federal court judge basically looked at the case and said there is evidence that he said the U.S. court-martial system, which is different from the Canadian court-martial system, which was reformed, I guess, in the 80s or 90s. But the U.S. court-martial system, it does not meet international standards of fairness because of the structure of it. The commanding officer decides on you know, who hears it, on you know, the punishment, all of this kind of thing. So that was a court decision that basically supported what we're saying, is you can't get a fair shake in the United States. U.S. war resisters who have gone before a court-martial, like Kim Rivera, have not been allowed to make the argument that they felt it was morally impossible for them to participate. And if anything, what they have argued about what they saw in Iraq has been used against them to ensure they get a harsher punishment. So they can't get a fair shake in that system. And so those arguments have been you know, the federal court has agreed with some of these things. I'm not saying they agreed with everything that war resisters may have put forward in these court cases, but that's a very significant finding. And that is part of what's at stake with this litigation on Tuesday and Wednesday.
Okay.
And so there are other things that the courts have found that also support the arguments that war resisters are making, in particular, the evidence of the systematic nature of abuses of international humanitarian law. These are the reasons why people came here in Canada in the first place. It was because of what the ground truth of the war in Iraq was.
So have you caught the Liberal Party? Because they had certainly made at least insinuated that they would be, you know, supportive and of resistors and express compassion on their behalf. Do you have any like ironclad promises they make that they appear to have broken?
I think it's we certainly can't say that they've promised anything. What we have to go on is the fact that in the past, under the Harper government, all of the Liberals who were present in the House at the time that motions came forward saying that the government should cease deportation proceedings against war resisters and that they should be allowed to stay in Canada, all of the Liberals who were in the House at the time, which is the vast majority of them, voted in favor of it. So, you know, Minister of Immigration John McCallum voted in favor of that motion. So did Justin Trudeau. That's one thing we have to go on. Now, of course, we have a much increased group of Liberal MPs now in the House of Commons. And there's been quite a turnover, of course, since 2008, 2009, when those motions came forward. However, in the lead up to the election, we sent out a sort of, a letter asking them to support war resisters being allowed to stay in Canada should they form the new government, the next government. And the reply we got from many of the MPs who responded was a sort of a standard reply. And if it's okay, I'll read it out.
Please do.
So your listeners can understand. Their response to our correspondence was, "The Liberal Party of Canada has consistently held the view that the Canadian government should not turn its back on Americans who have refused to participate in wars in which Canada refused to participate and which had not been authorized by the UN Security Council. We believe that Canada should have allowed those people seeking sanctuary in Canada for their opposition to the Iraq war the opportunity to apply for permanent residence status so long as they did not have a criminal record." So it's a slightly, you know, it's not what we've been asking for. I think we've asked for a much more straightforward, that they should be not just allowed to apply for permanent resident status, but that they should be allowed to stay at this point. Nonetheless, it tells you that they disagreed with the treatment, clearly, that the war resistors received under the Harper government. So that's what we have. We also had, there was a liberal fundraiser in Winnipeg, I believe, in July of last year, so in the lead up to the federal election. And at that time, the spouse of one of the war resistors, Joshua Key's spouse, Alexina, raised the question, asking Justin Trudeau, would a Liberal government proceed in a different way and let war resistors stay? And that the reply that he gave, in essence, I would say, just to be fair to what he said, because I don't have a transcript before me, but essentially was that a new government would look at these cases with a view to compassion and fairness. So that's what we have to go on.
So then, do you have any insights into exactly why that appears not to be the case now, that they're letting this litigation go through? And, you know, is it simply a question of being too busy, or what does your best instincts tell you is happening here?
This is really an important question, because it's conceivable that, of course, it's been 5 months since we've had the election. Our first meetings with MPs were over 4 months ago. It's been incredibly busy on the question of the Syrian refugees. So there's no doubt that the Minister of Immigration has had a lot to work on. But I don't think it's possible that this simply wasn't noticeable to them as an issue. We have had lobby meetings across the country, very pointed discussions about this particular issue, the litigation, stopping the litigation. We have written to the Minister of Justice and reminding her of the mandate letter that the Justin Trudeau sent to her about what the priority for the Ministry of Justice should be. Because, of course, just so people understand, the lawyers who are going to be arguing against war resistors on Tuesday and Wednesday are Department of Justice lawyers. Their client is the Minister of Immigration and also the Minister of Justice. It's slightly, you know, it's a little complex structure. In the mandate letter that Trudeau sent to the Minister of Justice, he said one of the priorities should be to review our litigation strategy. This should include early decisions to end appeals or positions that are not consistent with our commitments, the charter, or our values. And we certainly feel, and we've argued, that the litigation that was launched by the former Conservative government is not consistent with Canadian views or the Liberal Party's position. As stated, like I said, in the correspondence they sent to us. So why are they letting it go? All I can think is that they agree with going forward with it, because certainly the Minister of Immigration has the power to say we are not pursuing this litigation, as they did with, for example, the appeal of the court decision on interim federal health. You'll probably remember that Stephen Harper cut funding or cut health care for refugee claimants in Canada. And that went to court, and the court said that you cannot do that. You cannot deny refugees health care. And the Conservative government said, we're going to appeal that decision. We're going to spend resources of the Canadian government to appeal this decision. When the Trudeau government came in, they said, we're not going to appeal this. We're going to drop this appeal. We're going to drop this litigation. So that's what could happen in this case. It has not happened. And so really, it's anyone's guess why that is. And it's a question I hope that Canadians will ask of their elected representatives. We certainly are encouraging people to write to the Minister of Immigration on our website at resistors.ca. You can see a model message that people can send asking than to stop this litigation.
Michelle Robidoux, thank you very much for your time.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
You've been speaking with Michelle Robidoux, a campaigner with the War Resisters Support Campaign based in Toronto, Canada. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Our next guest raised concerns about how the U.S. military-industrial complex may be using the Canadian census as a means of obtaining information about Canadians. I spoke to her recently about her research into the U.S. company Statistics Canada contracted with in preparing the 2016 census. Sandra Finley is a community activist and a former leader of the Green Party of Saskatchewan. She was a longtime resident of that province until she moved to B.C. a couple of years ago. She served on the University of Saskatchewan Senate and has been outspoken through her website and other fora on issues related to war and peace, sustainability, and Canadian sovereignty. 10 years ago, she drew a lot of press attention for refusing to fill out the 2006 long-form census, alluding to the involvement of the defense contractor Lockheed Martin Corporation in that process. Tell us more about her experience and the ongoing concern she has about the census, privacy rights in the country, and Lockheed Martin is Sandra Finley. Sandra, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me, Michael.
Could I first of all just get you to explain in your own words, what was your personal motivation for taking such a stand?
So it became known in the activist networks that work had been contracted out to Lockheed Martin Corporation. I recall that the Quakers, the Society of Friends in Nova Scotia, had done a lot of research on who Lockheed Martin is and what they do in the world. I had read that and concluded there's no way that these people should be involved with the database on Canadians at Statistics Canada. At that time, you know, I didn't know. I mean, of course, what's happened is that over the years, the information about them and their operations has expanded. But at that time, even it was known, for example, that they operate outside Canadian and international law. And I simply don't understand why it is that you reward companies that operate, as I say, outside our laws. So, for example, they were manufacturers of landmines. They were, and then later following that, they were manufacturers of the cluster munitions, and those are both illegal under Canadian law. What we have learned since then is that they were the number one, what's called contract interrogator at the American offshore prisons, such as Abu Ghraib, and I mean Guantanamo. People would be very familiar with what happened at Guantanamo Bay, the torture and other things that, again, are completely outside of the operation of international law. And so they were a number one participant in that. And again, those are people that you just do not reward with large contracts. Their presence in Canada has been to promote the purchase by Canadians of their F-35 stealth bombers. And there's been lots of resistance, thank goodness, to those contracts.
So at that point, it was basically just a question of not wanting to deal with a kind of a company that sort of got blood on its hands, like certain mining companies that assault Indigenous peoples or other companies that have these sorts of unethical practices, that the Canadian government shouldn't be involved with them, just as a partner.
Yes, very much so. And at that time, there was also a lot of concern about the Patriot Act and its effect on access to databases. So, I recall that that in British Columbia there had been an attempt by the government to outsource the administration of health records, and American corporations were in line to provide that service. And so the BC Privacy Commissioner in 2004 did an analysis of the Patriot Act, and that included consultations that were, I think, quite wide. And what was concluded was that the Patriot Act superseded any laws that might exist in Canada. And if an American corporation had access to a database on Canadians, the way that act worked is that the American government, so you'd be talking the Defense Department, I presume, maybe CIA, FBI, NSA, could order that they be given access to the database, and the owner of the database, which in the case of Statistics Canada, it would be like the Government of Canada, there was no requirement at all to notify the owner of the database if access was provided. So all you had to have was an American corporation and or a subsidiary, a Canadian subsidiary of that entity in Canada with, working on a database so that they had access to it. And as I say, they would be compelled to hand over the access to the database to the American government. And so that was another bone of contention. And today, of course, that has morphed into the spying that's been done by the NSA, the American NSA, the surveillance that they are doing. And Edward Snowden and Glenn Greenwald have done a wonderful job of, helping to expose the amount of, I guess what you could say is the insecurity of databases, because what happens is that the American interest in surveillance will forge what is referred to as backdoor access to a database if they can't obtain legal front door access. So again, it's a matter of installing the means at the back end of the database there, so that the American surveillance system can access the database that way. So so now we don't talk the Patriot Act anymore and its implications for the security of personal information on Canadians that's in that database. We talk about it in relationship to that known surveillance function.
Yeah, the Stats Can has insisted that your information is confidential, and that this Lockheed Martin is just supplying the software or the technology that processes it. But I think what you're saying is that they have, when you talk about backdoor access, it's like a special key that they have that can unlock anything that's consistent with the software, so they can get it if they really wanted to.
Yeah, I don't see how that cannot be a factor. And then there's other, other information that people know right now. And for me personally, another issue is the credibility of the information that we get from Statistics Canada. And it is not always the truth. So you get, first of all, reassurances. Oh, no, this is just fine. No, of course, nobody has access to this database. We'll ensure that they don't. But then simultaneously, it is a fact, and I know this from my trial, and I know it from subsequent information, that what's happened now in the world is that the American that the Americans under Lockheed Martin have forged relationships amongst different nations for the, so that their census operations are compatible, that the information, the data that they collect on citizens is compatible. So if and that would apply in, we know, like, first of all, of course, it's the United States at the leadership. Then there's Canada. We know that for sure. Then there is the United Kingdom and people over there, in, like in the UK, they mounted resistance to Lockheed Martin's involvement in their database on, you know, for their on citizens. And then you've got Australia and New Zealand are both part of a, you know, that network.
And the Five Eyes.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. I didn't know whether your listeners would be familiar with that acronym or term. Yes, absolutely. And I don't know how far beyond it extends, but, you know, one thing that that I did find on the Statistics Canada website by, you know, that there's four items on it. If you Google, or pardon me, if you search Lockheed Martin on the Statistics Canada website, there are four entries that come up if you do a, you know, the largest search possible. And two of those are travel expense claims that have been submitted to the government to pay. And in the title of those travel expenses is travel to the it's like an international forum on censuses, and with Lockheed Martin, meetings with Lockheed Martin in its role as what's called on the expense claim the steering committee for that, you know, for those operations. So to me, it's pretty clear that there are very, very serious issues for Canadians around Lockheed Martin's involvement at Statistics Canada, no matter whether, you know, if they say that, oh, well, they're no longer involved, well, yes, they are actually still involved because of this, for one thing, the international collaboration between the Five Eye countries at the minimum, and Lockheed Martin is part of that. You know, they're providing the steering committee for it.
Got the Lockheed Martin is essentially, you know, essentially helping form these networks that allow all of this data to be centralized.
That's, I would say yes, and when you have, as I recall looking at a defense strategy for Canada, and right near the top of it, what the strategy listed in the Canadian document for defense was that we would have interoperability and compatibility. Compatibility first would come first, and then interoperability. Because what you need is, if you've got compatibility in databases or in, you know, the things that you're undertaking to do, then you've got interoperability. You don't have that interoperability if everything is incompatible. And so what you have is that also, I mean, Lockheed Martin is a contractor to the NSA, that's the height of the surveillance function in the United States. And they are surveilling not only their own people, but, you know, as is known from those, between WikiLeaks, Julian Assange and Edward Snowden, you know that is, you know, that, for example, Angela Merkel from Germany was, and France, those companies have been outraged by the fact that the Americans are surveilling them too. And when you say surveilling, it is, you know, actually intercepting and looking at, having access to, you know, what are government communications. So what you get, and what I think is a problem for Canadians, is that you get a loss of sovereignty. It is as though this, you know, American empire is extending its tentacles, and has. And one of the
It sounds like Lockheed Martin. I mean, it's not just another nefarious private company, like a Walmart or Monsanto or whatever. I mean, they seem to. It almost seems to be in a class by itself as a special tool for enabling this whole centralizing apparatus. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. It would be very, very difficult to draw a line between where the American, so-called Defense Department, I think it's the War Department, but at any rate, to draw a line that a separation between the American Defense Department, the CIA, the FBI, the NSA, and Lockheed Martin Corporation, you'd be very, very hard-pressed to do that.
What about, I mean, I know you're a University of Saskatchewan senator. I think your term's coming up soon, if it hasn't already. What about how that impacts academia with databases and universities? Is that an issue?
Well, for me, that part of what people should know is that so what you have is, for example, you can see Lockheed Martin kind of worming its way into Canada through through its involvement in something like the database at Statistics Canada. But what they've also done, and this has started up some time ago, is that they started going into the universities too. And they're, for your listeners, if they were to do a search on the Minerva Initiative, what you find is that there is a stated, written down policy in places where there are American interests and this is, maybe just aimed originally at American universities, but what they've stated as a policy is that they need to form relationships with the universities, not for the purpose of, specifically, they don't talk about engineering departments, for example, which you could perhaps understand, but they're specifically talking about the social sciences, those ways that people have of understanding human behavior or manipulating human behavior or
psychological operations.
Yeah. And so at the University of Saskatchewan, for example, they came on campus promoting their what are called collaboration topics. And so then they invite the, members of faculty to submit proposals for funding to them. They then dictate what research will get done. And in the collaboration topics, as they were presented at the U of S, they were very, very, to me, terrible initiatives around war, basically, is what they were. But then what you had happening is that when at Senate, we challenged the collaborations with Lockheed Martin, and I think this is how they are a corrupting influence. What you had was the at that time acting head of the engineering faculty, who's a prominent longtime member of faculty at the U of S, saying no, that what they were doing was their interest was in the development of green technologies. And that's what that's what it was all about. But that contradicted totally what Lockheed Martin's own proposals for collaboration topics stated. And they are buying their way with First Nations communities. I think what they found was that it's maybe more difficult for them in Canada to get the social license to do what they want because we're a smaller country. We're, well connected. We can get information to other citizens perhaps more easily so that people understand what this company is actually all about. And so to buy that social license, that acceptability, they're now, you know, Brad Wall, the premier of Saskatchewan, I recall, now this is going back, you know, a couple of years at least, but he announced that there was this collaboration between the First Nations people on his side of the province in the Swift Current area, Lockheed Martin, and then they pull in government money as well, and what they were funding was actually green technology. It was some efforts around wind energy.
There's another angle to the concerns you've raised that doesn't seem to penetrate very deeply into the Canadian psyche at present. I mean, it was with the Liberals returning to power and the long form census returning. It seemed to a lot of, you know, progressive minded Canadians were overjoyed by that. And you know, one stickly little point that you raise in your writing is that we have a charter right to privacy, and the long form census appears to be a breach of that privacy. I mean, people, you can't, you know, force people to give up that, to give up their privacy, but that's essentially what the census does if you're being penalized if you don't comply, right?
Yes, and thank you for bringing that up, Michael. And that was the basis for the defense during the time that I was in and out of court, was that we have a charter right to privacy of information. And it's quite eloquently stated. You know, it's, you know, this personal information is information that people in a free and democratic society would want to have, so you've got your personal information, but you cannot be forced to, you know, to disclose it to the government. And that wisdom of that charter right arises out of the experience of, for example, the Nazi regime during the time of the Second World War. And ironically, or maybe not ironically, what had happened there was that the American census became mechanized, and eventually IBM bought up that technology, and so it was of assistance in tabulating the results of these manual censuses in the United States. But then IBM took it over to Germany. That was the first company over in Europe that they went to say, here, you want to mechanize your census and we'll help you do it. And so they set up the punch cards that older people might be familiar with, and the Hollerith, what was called the Hollerith machine. And they had, you know, at the height of the Nazi influence in Germany alone, they had warehouses of women who were, and people that were census workers who went door to door collecting data, bringing it back to the key punch operators. And what they were able to do is, for example, identify a Jewish person down to what you refer to as an eighth blood. So that was all census data by which that was done. And then they set up these subsidiaries in other European countries, Austria, you know, there's a whole list of them, and they're on my blog, so that when the Nazis were moving into other countries, there was, in many cases, already census data there that they were able to access that allowed them to go out, you know, to go down to the train station or to the town square and list, put up a list of, okay, these people report to, you know, the train station and they were headed for an, you know, extermination. That was what enabled that. So what you have, so as I say, people then be, and it's true of any police state or militaristic state, a characteristic of them is that they have detailed files on citizens. That's why we have the Charter Right to Privacy of Personal Information, to say, no, you have to guard against that. Well, and what you have happening at Statistics Canada is that there is a census long form that, of course, to me, went way above and beyond demanding under threat of law. You know, you're going to get prosecuted and fined and jailed if you don't supply this personal information to us. But in addition to that, and here's what a lot of people don't realize, is you say, if you look at, you've got one database at Statistics Canada. The census happens once every 5 years. So once every 5 years, And it used to be a third of the population. Now, I think because of resistance, they're saying, okay, one quarter of households will get the census long form to fill in. And, but then in addition to that, regularly throughout each and every week and year, in between censuses, they conduct surveys. And Statistics Canada tells citizens, this, they give them the same threat as they do regarding the census. You have to supply this information. And if you don't, you can be prosecuted, fined, sent to jail. But in fact, this, and the Statistics Act says that surveys are voluntary. So Statistics Canada doesn't, they're not even operating by the rule of law. They are governed by the Statistics Act. The Statistics Act says that surveys are effectively voluntary. But what you've got, I guess the point that I'm trying to make is that it's not just once every 5 years that the personal information is being collected. There's lots of personal information demanded in these surveys, and whether it's the, there's the labor force survey, there's the household spending survey, there's the, the census long form became the national household survey. So it's got the same questions as the census long form, but all of that stuff is feeding into one database. So you're getting into pretty dangerous territory because your name is on your record in that database. And that I know from, during my trial, that was, one point I was still representing myself, and I did, even though I'm not qualified to do, and I didn't do a great job, but I cross-examined the Statistics Canada fellow who was at my trial, who was the head of the census operations, and was able to delve into some of those questions. And yes, you're, so that was under oath. Yes, your name is on there, and like I say, those files are accumulating regularly, and that is a great concern in a democracy. And so here you are from the University of Manitoba, but it's one of the big proponents, as you pointed out, like there's these people who are waving the flag saying, yay, we're getting the long form census back. Well, it's, to me, it's like you're saying, yay, we're moving one step further toward into this detailed files on citizens, which are only characteristic of police states. You just don't do that in a democracy.
You've given us quite a lot to think about, Sandra Finley, and I know your website is quite a wealth of information. It's but basically a network of different people who are combining their knowledge that doesn't seem to quite fit inside the mainstream narrative. So. I'm sorry we have to kind of leave it there, but your website again is sandrafinley.ca.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, and thanks so much, Michael. I appreciate the opportunity to discuss it with you, and hopefully it'll help other Canadians.
Okay, thank you. We've been speaking with Sandra Finley, a community activist, former leader of the Green Party, and her website again is sandrafinley.ca.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.